Hello, and welcome to day two, episode two, of the 2018 World Federation of Hemophilia World Congress coverage from the Bloodstream Podcast. I'm Bloodstream Podcast host and Bloodstream Media founder Patrick James Lynch. I am here in Glasgow, Scotland, for the 2018 World Congress from the WFH and bringing you these daily recap podcasts after each of the 5 days of World Congress. Recorded the first yesterday, which I'm imagining most of you have heard. If any of you have not, welcome. And yeah, doing one of these after Congress's day each day. They are raw and uncut, as established yesterday in our first episode. I am the editor on these. However, I am not an editor. So while my team is busy working with the WFH on video and photo work for their purposes at the Congress here, I'm one man banding this operation. So forgive the forgive what hopefully is the charming rawness of these episodes, as they are essentially my unbroken monologue, as I try to give you the insights and the takeaways from my experience each day, and not just my experience as in what I went through, but also observing other people's tweets and online responses to takeaways from sessions, conversations in the hallway. You know, you can't go to everything at these. So I'm trying to both let you know what I was paying attention to and struck me, and then also what I know from others that kind of stood out as key information from the day. So so let's get into it here. I have in front of me a few different materials to help us process day two. And actually, the first thing that came out this morning, I may have mentioned it yesterday, was the Congress Daily. So it's covering the things that happened last night, opening session and the reception, and then a little bit of stuff from the days prior. As I'd mentioned yesterday, there was an NMO training, there was a youth workshop throughout the week. So there have been some components of World Congress that were taking place well before yesterday as well. So a couple things that stood out for me in the World Congress that I want to shout out. One of them was a quote here from Glenn Pierce on gene therapy, obviously a huge topic of conversation at this year's World Congress. In a presentation that Dr. Glenn Pierce had given, according to the Congress Daily, he concluded by saying that although gene therapy has the ability to transform treatment of hemophilia, more research, including late-stage trials, is needed. In addition, disparities in access to treatment between developed and developing countries must be addressed. So, you know, not breaking news there to say that we need more research, but I think the point being that we have reason for excitement, but we're not at the finish line yet. There's still more work to be done. Clinical trials are a necessary part and a necessary step to bringing a new medication to life, and not something that we can kind of look past because of excitement. And on the topic of gene therapy, a takeaway from the day before, a couple days ago, I saw a quote from Dr. Kathy High, the founder of, I think she's the founder of Spark Therapeutics, and a legendary hematologist in our community. But she made the point that it took 22 years from the first human clinical trial to get to the first licensed product in gene therapy, which took place only a few months ago. So just kind of interesting to put it on that timeline of 22 years. And I was listening to a couple stories of people talking about the early days of gene therapy work, you know, 20 some odd years ago, 20-ish years ago, and where we've gotten to now. And they're quite excited, whereas there are others who feel as though, in, you know, the patient community especially, we've been hearing about gene therapy for a long time, and we just keep hearing about it and hearing about it, and we're finally at a precipice. But helpful to remember that we're not there yet. And I appreciate as well Glenn's referencing the need to make sure that the developed and developing countries are being accounted for. And I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. Also wanted to point out there was another session that was done on the need for a database, a strong evidence base for making certain claims about our community. So in a session titled Advocating for Better Outcomes, there were examples of successful regional advocacy programs. And there's a quote here, by leveraging evidence-based data from 11 clinical studies, China was able to demonstrate the treatment benefits and cost effectiveness of low-dose prophylaxis to overcome a crisis in care for young boys with hemophilia. India and Nigeria formed statewide coordination committees and held evidence-based stakeholder meetings to research the wider hemophilia community. So these points were made in support of the WFH's new annual global survey, or excuse me, new bleeding disorders registry, which collects data from an increasing number of HTCs and I think maybe NMOs. I'm not sure about that, but I know the HTCs from around the world, and the importance of having that data to make evidence-based advocacy claims, which are more compelling when trying to convince government and government officials, ministers of health, etc., of our needs. So an important point there about the need for strong evidence. I think that's about it from the Congress that I'm going to mention. Yeah, let's keep this moving. Let's keep this Uncut, Unbroken podcast moving. And so then today, so at 8:30 this morning, and I want to give you a rundown of how these days are structured, because yesterday is a little bit of an outlier, day one. There were some programs during the day and then the opening session, but now each day there is a plenary at 8:30, a half-hour plenary each day of these next today and the next 3 days. And then 9:15 to 9:45 is a short session. There's two different parallel sessions taking place during that window. Then there's a little break. Then there are three session blocks during the day for hour and a half long sessions, one from 10:15 to 11:45, another from 2:15 to 3:45, and a final from 4:30 to 6 o'clock, which only just ended a short while ago here. So those are the three bulk times where there are concurrent sessions going on, and I'll tell you about the sessions I attended and what I took away from the others. And then in the evenings, there's a cultural event tomorrow night. There's a farewell dinner on Thursday. Tonight there is an industry symposium that I'm obviously not at. And then Wednesday is also a free evening. So that's just the structure of the day. Today's plenary was given by Elaine Vey, the president of WFH, who spoke a couple times yesterday, and he was introduced by Marijke Vandenberg, the VP Medical for the WFH. And I have to say, it was a really powerful plenary. There was a video that was played. Well, first there were awards given out. Let's see here. I have the names. I'm going to butcher these, though, if I try to go through the names. Well, come on, Patrick, you can do it. So there were three awards given out. At the top of the session, the President's Award for excellence in building, not necessarily capacity building, but innovators and leaders in areas around the world. So are the recipients Megan Adeniran from Nigeria, the founder of Hemophilia of Nigeria, someone we've spoken about on the Bloodstream podcast prior. Maria del Carmen Aguirre, I'm probably mispronouncing that. She's from Honduras. And Bogdan Gajowski. Man, someone should just do a supercut of all the mispronunciations on these daily recaps from Poland, who I actually also think is staying at my hotel, and I think I had breakfast across from him this morning. But those three individuals were recognized for their exceptional commitment to the community and to the growth of their community in their area. And then we moved into a video and some data presentations from Elaine that really kind of hit on an overarching theme, or at least what I perceive to be an overarching theme of access and accountability in the pursuit of increasing diagnosis and factor concentrate globally in order to truly accomplish the treatment for all mission that the WFH has. And what I found so kind of so compelling about the opening, about the plenary, was the amount of data that Elaine presented to literally put on screen the statement that we are not closing the gap. We have heard about closing the gap, this gap in disparity, it must be closed. And he pointed out through data how we are not yet really accomplishing that. At one point, he broke down the numbers to illustrate that there are 42 babies with hemophilia born every day. If we go by the world population, 1 in 10,000 births, you break that all down, 42 babies a day. But currently, we are only diagnosing 16 people with hemophilia per day. So obviously, not only are we not closing the gap, but every day that this is true, the gap, in fact, widens. And he continued to present some data that I don't want to say was reason for despair, but it was just very humbling how much work is truly still yet to be done. And I think that was probably, I mean, what do I know? It was great. I thought it was great. I thought it was necessary and bold. And he frankly didn't mince words when challenging corporate, the manufacturers who are here, the drug makers who are here to increase their amount of donation. And he did point out how Bioverativ and Sobi made that big commitment a few years back. And that there was hope that more companies would follow suit in the amount of their give. And while many companies do give, more can be done. And there was a strong statement from Elaine to say more needs to be done. But I should also just acknowledge this diagnosis discrepancy is kind of separate. So there were two focuses. The one was on access to medication and the availability of medication, and his call to action there was really for more donations to be made. And then the other component of the plenary was on the need to increase diagnosis, how we must improve our diagnostic practices. And he put out something of a challenge for people to think of ways that we can increase our diagnostic practices. So a strong start to the day, really making clear this disparity. Again, we're hearing more and more and more all the time about the disparity, at least in my opinion and in conversations with people. It seems to just be in the forefront of sessions more and more often, and I think that's a good thing because the need is tremendous. So that was this morning's plenary, and then after that, let me see here. What was the first session that I can chat with you about? Was it the one on pain? I believe it may have been the one on pain. Yeah, it was. So really, really interesting, and actually the presenter, Natalie Roussel, I believe her name is. She gave a great presentation. I'll be frank, a lot of it, the science behind pain is a bit too complex for me. What I certainly was able to appreciate is just how complex it is. And Natalie came back to the idea of needing to understand pain better as treaters, being able to speak more specifically about it to our patients, making sure patients are staying curious about their pain and assessing correctly the difference between acute and chronic pain, between bleed-related pain and arthritis, arthropathy-related pain. And she went into how these literally process different in the brain and the neural pathways. And again, the specifics of the science is too much for my simple brain. But it was clear that it is important that we have better insight into pain mechanisms in order to establish the proper treatment plan. Because if it's a certain kind of pain, then maybe this type of medication might work. If it's another kind of pain, well, then medication may not work. If it's this kind of pain, maybe this other kind of medication would work. But if we're not clear on any of this, then we're just kind of shooting blind. So she certainly made that point clear and a couple times pointed out just how packed the room was. And, you know, made the case that that goes to show that this is a need, that this is something people are paying attention to, but that we need to understand more with regard to hemophilia specifically. She had expertise, I believe, in back pain, not necessarily specific to hemophilia. And she made the case a few times for more studies to be done specific to pain and hemophilia. After that session, I attended the What's Your Everest session, which was opened by a transparent and, you know, I guess obvious admission that the session was inspired by Chris Bombardier's summiting of Mount Everest, which was very sweet. And each of the four presenters were excellent. I won't go into too much detail. If you are curious and if you're a Twitter user, I did a lot of tweeting today. And if you look up the hashtag WFH2018 on Twitter, hashtag WFH2018, you'll find my and other people's tweets from today that are tagged as such if you want to get more granular. But I will say of the four presentations, something that stuck out to me that was actually really crystallized in a conversation with some friends after the session was Megan Adideron, who we mentioned earlier. She was one of the award recipients this morning as well. She really used the conceit of Chris's climbing Everest and the seven summits to help tell her story in a very different way. So she even made the point that often people will make remarks to her, oh, you had me in tears, you had me crying. She's showing these pictures of kids with untreated bleeds, and of course they're horrifying to look at and just so startling and upsetting. And she said, you know, I'm not doing that this time, this is different. And she really used the geography of Everest and the references of base camp, advanced base camp, camp two, camp three, the summit, and then the seven summits to identify with the seven summits instead of the seven mountains that you have to climb. For Megan, it was here are my seven big challenges. And then on Everest, instead of base camp, camp one, camp two, it was like, okay, base camp for me was guilt. That was my starting place. I had guilt. And then as I went up the ladder, there was disagreements with my husband about the right decision to be made. And then I had this challenge. And so she really leveraged the conceit to not just tell her. So a few things. She leveraged the conceit, in my opinion, to tell her story in a way that had a more inspirational angle to it. So it wasn't quite so dire. And not that there's anything wrong with just exposing people to the brass tacks of, hey, this is what it looks like in my country, and it's really, really, it's a desperate situation. But she used this aspirational motif of Everest and the Seven Summits to frame her story differently, and I thought that was really neat, and it just goes to in my opinion, and I'm obviously quite biased, having directed Bombardier Blood and been very close with Chris throughout this process, it goes again to say how useful it is for us to have this this accomplishment to point to as something inspirational and aspirational, that it's influencing the way that Megan Adideron is telling her story, and it was influencing the way that the four presenters told their stories. But another thing that I thought was impressive about what Megan did and what she spoke to, and each of the presenters, you know, they're from four different countries, gentleman from Mauritius, gentleman from the UK, and then I'm blanking on where our final presenter was from, but four different countries, so four different perspectives. But they all used this Everest motif. So they each had, to some degree or another, an inspirational and aspirational quality to sharing stories of overcoming obstacles and challenges, but it was in a very forward-looking way. So I thought that was really neat. And Megan in particular, she also used the opportunity to identify two things that I think are super important. One, how some of these challenges and burdens of disease management are much different in the developed world versus the developing world. And then additionally, how culture interacts with treatment and care. And she made references to aspects of African culture, aspects of Nigerian culture specifically, aspects of her family culture, you know, whether that's indicative of a greater Nigerian culture or not, her family culture and the way that interacted with treatment and care. So really important nuances to appreciate when thinking about hemophilia and bleeding disorders from a global perspective. Okay, and then the afternoon I was taking some meetings with people, so I did not attend a session in the middle there to speak to necessarily. At the end of the day, I attended a session on transitions, which, I mean, frankly, my big takeaway from that was in the one of the concluding slides from one of the presenters, one of the points was transition looks different for every patient and for every center. And I just thought, like, well, therein lies the rub. That's part of the challenge with transition, is just how different it is. That being said, I did appreciate that she was the presenter referencing some precedent, or not some precedent, rather, but what is the name of the body? Six Core Elements of Healthcare Transition, as developed by the National Alliance to Advance Adolescent Health. And those six elements are transition policy, transition trafficking and monitoring, transition readiness, transition planning, transfer of care, transfer completion. So those are, you know, really broad concepts, but at least to help clarify thinking around how you think about transition and your approach to it, I suppose there's good research to back up breaking the thinking into these six categories. She was able to get into a little bit of detail, but not much with her time. But she did at least tee up these six core elements to consider when developing a program for transition, and reference that hemophilia treatment centers around the U.S. are doing it. So transition, I think, I want to see something that kind of screams with solutions when it comes to transition and these and kids and young adults making that leap into the next phase of life. But I do think the point that it's individualized and different for the individuals and centers alike is both true and somewhat unfortunate, right? Because it just means it's that much harder to wrap our arms around when it's so individualized. So anyway, but putting that to bed. So that session was going on. That was the last session. That was part of that final chunk during the day. And then I have a couple other, I just pulled up various tweets from people that I saw that I thought might be worth shouting out, pieces of information that were presented at other sessions. Professor Michael Makris, we've talked about him before. He's from the UK here in Sheffield. And he posted from one of the sessions that once a week or once every 2 weeks treatment of hemophilia A is coming. Bioverativ have a new drug called B901. Is that what it is? B9? BIV01? Low dose of BIVV001? Well, I wasn't in the session, and the slide and his tweet are, there's a little discrepancy, but whatever it's called, with a markedly longer half-life. So the half-life products for hemophilia A have not been as long as I think once hoped they would be. But evidently, what Bioverativ is working on could be, in the professor's words, a game changer for hemophilia A replacement therapy with a 37-hour high factor activity half-life, according to this one slide. So that's pretty meaningful. Likewise, Genentech presented some more data from their study of the treatment of or the use of Hemlibra in treating people with hemophilia A without inhibitors. Bleed reduction was, I believe, 96 to 97%. They were able to reduce bleeding. It's a huge number. And I think I saw a slide as well. Let me see if I can pull this up here. But I think I saw a slide that actually stated that the people who were a part of that study, none of them, when asked, mentioned an interest in switching to their previous product. I'm nearly certain I saw that somewhere, which is very interesting. And I suppose not terribly surprising if you've had a very positive experience. All right, a couple other things to mention here. Let's see. Nope, we already talked about that. Oh, we hit on that. Very good. Hey, look at me. I'm getting ahead of myself. So in one session, Brian O'Mahony, the CEO of the Irish Hemophilia Society, had a snapshot of a slide in reference that Dr. Dan Hart speculates that inhibitor rates may increase if pups, previously undiagnosed patients, initially treated with new novel agents in first decade of life and use factor VIII restricted to treating on-demand bleeds. So this is something that there's, and again, it's speculation, but the idea that with these novel therapies, if we're not exposing pups to factor VIII in as early in life as we had been, are we simply delaying the inevitability of them developing an inhibitor within the first 50 exposures, if we're delaying that that exposure time because of the new non-factor replacement therapies that are available, these novel agents, so to speak. So this is speculative. We can't know this at this point, but it is a good thing to be thinking about as we consider all the different nuances that come with a new classes of product. Let's see, we're at the 20-minute mark here, so I want to make sure to be try to keep us a little bit tight. Another tweet here, the WFH president, oh, this is from this morning's plenary, states that 12 billion international units of factor VIII were sold in 2016. Requirement, if all diagnosed people with hemophilia were treated to a trough level of 1%, which is the marker that we so often use, although is 1% really enough? If all diagnosed people were treated, we'd need those IUs to increase to 33 billion from 12. So that's just to get all currently diagnosed people to 1%. And that would be, we'd need to almost triple the amount of factor, that was sold to make that a reality. So again, just putting into some context the disparity of, well, I don't know if disparity is the right word, but the gap between the amount of factor we have and the amount of factor we need. I guess that's the simplest way to put it. And I think that's kind of it. So I hope that gives you some sense of what went on today. I gave you some insights from the sessions I was a part of and a couple of shout outs from the sessions that I wasn't. A look ahead to tomorrow to let you know what we'll be talking about tomorrow. So in the morning, there's the VP, Marijke Vandenberg, who this morning was presenting, our plenary speaker, will be the plenary speaker. And then there's those two different sessions. It looks like women with bleeding disorders that's a bit of a track tomorrow. So that those shorter breakouts following the opening, one of them is on women with bleeding disorders, clinical and psychological issues. There is, there's a couple other sessions tomorrow on women with bleeding disorders that I plan to attend. There's one on closing the gap, about the GAP program and how that's been doing and where it needs to grow or where we go from here, so to speak. So yeah, a couple other sessions. I don't know, probably not terribly interesting for me to just read off the page to you about what sessions are happening tomorrow, but I'll do the same thing tomorrow as I did today. And again, if you want to take a look at more contributions from me and others, there's many of the best people in bleeding disorders are here, and some of them have Twitter accounts. So I would recommend, if you are listening to this, you've got some digital media interest in you, hop over to Twitter, even if you don't have an account, and just look up the hashtag WFH2018. You'll see how much information is being shared and tagged so that it can be aggregated by those who are interested. So do check all that stuff out. What else? I guess that's it, everybody. So I hope once again that this was useful, the unbroken monologue that is our daily recap here from the WFH's World Congress in Glasgow, Scotland. That's it for day two. We'll be back tomorrow with a recap of day three. If you're new to the Bloodstream podcast, please head over to bloodstreampod.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher. If you like this, if you think this is valuable, the podcast in general, you can rate us on iTunes. It actually helps people find the show. They index differently based on ratings, so that would be super helpful. And come on back tomorrow to hear about day three from World Congress. Talk to you tomorrow.